That's Jimmy Smith, the undisputed master of the Hammond B3 organ, and a phenomenal group of sidemen, including Mr. T, Stanley Turrentine, on tenor sax, opening up on Midnight Special. That was recorded in 1960. And Kenny Burrell, the legendary guitarist, and Donald Bailey on drums are featured also on Midnight Special. Burrell, by the way, is a native of Detroit and a graduate of Wayne State. He's in his 80s. Our guest today ought to appreciate that, because our guest also is from Detroit, Dr. Thomas C. Pedroni, P-E-D-R-O-N-I. He's an associate professor of curriculum studies and critical policy sociology, and co-director of the Leonard Kaplan, he's director of the Leonard Kaplan Education Collaborative for Critical Urban Studies at Wayne State University. He has been fighting for quality community-controlled schools and against public school dismantling in Detroit since 2005. He was appointed to the Detroit Schools Task Force by the legendary education activist Helen Moore, who we had the privilege of speaking to just last year, of the Keep the Vote, No Takeover Coalition in 2012. Both organizations have been a leading voice in exposing the debacle of education in the city of Detroit, especially under emergency management. Now, we're talking to Dr. Pedroni today as a way of introducing, or should say reintroducing to you, because we have been discussing this issue in different ways. But I want to bring to your attention and for us to understand that what we are seeing all over the country, what looks like a fight here and a fight there, it's actually a coordinated plan. I talk about the word template a lot. And there is a template. Just about every major city in the United States with a sizable non-white population is experiencing a crisis in public school education. And that is not accidental, says our guest. He says, in fact, it is aligned with and reflects a historically racist philosophy and mindset that, despite pronouncements to the contrary, actually oppose equality and democracy. He says, in effect, this is a threat. These so-called urban centers with these large non-white populations are actually now seen as a kind of threat, an inconvenience to the power elite whose plans have entirely different requirements now. And we've seen it play out in cities like New Orleans, New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. You take your pick of any major urban center where you have a large population of non-white people, and you see the same thing happening. So we're discussing public school education and the battle, the racist attack on public school education, and the battle, of course, by people who insist that it is time to assert grassroots political power. It's a long, long introduction there, Dr. Pedroni, but I felt it necessary today to frame our discussion today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ms. Lee. And I think that was a
It's
very
your treat. It's your treat.
Your treat. Thank you so much, your treat. Very fitting introduction.
Thank you. When we talked last, and I'll get to that a little bit later in greater detail, you talked about the Katrina moment, and we will get to the significance of a Katrina moment. Could you explain how, in your view, education as a whole is undergoing a kind of accelerated, massive Katrina moment? What is the Katrina moment, and how is it expressing itself across the country?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question that requires a two-part answer. So, in one sense, it's valuable to talk about the crisis in public education itself. Unfortunately, most critics will stop there and won't make the bridge to think about the relationship between the crisis in public education and the struggle over our cities, particularly over who should get to inhabit our urban spaces in a way that is at least at the very minimum survivable, whether that should be simply white populations or whether there's still a place there for communities of color, especially lower income communities of color. There has recently been a lot of very valuable work by people like Pauline Lippman and by Kristen Buras. These are people who have inspired me deeply, and I try to do the same sort of work in Detroit, to say, yes, we should talk about the crisis in public education as a crisis brought about by neoliberalization of the educational sphere and the dismantling of the public sphere in general. But that sort of reading in itself doesn't bring enough into the critique that relates to race and space and the larger contest over the city, especially as that relates to accumulation and what some theorists have called accumulation by dispossession. So I think at the forefront of the kind of analysis we really need to bring are the interests, particularly of financial capital and real estate capital. Basically, our cities are places that, as we know from a lot of the recent important discourse by Richard Rothstein and others who have been doing this work for, you know, for decades now.
We had him on as well talking about this.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. That's a wonderful, wonderful connection, wonderful bridge for your audience. So hats off to you, Yatrice, for all the quality that you bring.
Thank you.
But you're welcome. It is important to note that we need to make sure that we keep our minds focused on the fact that our current state of our cities was something that was not just market generated. A lot of people will think that, you know, they think about de jure segregation, and de facto segregation, they'll kind of say, well, what we have now is basically market motivated, and these are just the places, the kinds of choices that people make in the marketplace, and that shouldn't be interfered with. There's nothing essentially wrong with it. But the fact of the matter is that we now know, because of the work of Richard Rothstein and many others, that these are actually the outcomes of the state at various levels, municipal, state, and federal, working very intentionally, subsidizing white flight, subsidizing the further capturing of advantage for more privileged families, particularly for white, affluent, and middle class and more affluent families. So everything from the subsidization of that flight through the construction of interstates, through various housing policies, through redlining, through blockbusting, through access to FHA loans and this sort of thing, have meant that the current arrangements we have, what Richard Rothstein and others have called the noose around the neck of the city for African Americans and Latinos and other communities of color, is actually something that was very intentionally crafted, not just an unintended effect of our state policy. So where does that lead us now? Well, the way that I think about it in places like Detroit, and it's applicable elsewhere as well, is there's a real branding problem for interests that are primarily represented in the housing and finance sectors, the real estate and finance sectors. Again, the urban growth machine, as some critical urban sociologists have referred to it. And that problem is that the branding was so successful in generating profit when one used racial fears as the basis for an exodus from the city. That was tremendously profitable for real estate capital, for finance capital, because you basically were realizing tremendous value, as Richard Rothstein has outlined, on both ends, both on the pushing out of whites from particular neighborhoods, on the selling of that housing to African Americans and other people of color at inflated prices, and then also on the suburban end where people were landing. There were lots of profit to be made with government subsidy as well for that industry. But so the branding problem now is that you were so successful in making places like Detroit be the living examples in the white imaginary of their greatest racial fears. And your problem is that you want to jump back in again. You want to jump back in and you realize, well, if we can reverse that whole shift, if we can get the churn, because the churn is where the profit is to be made. We have a movement of people across the U.S., of communities of color, of people who are have been living in poverty, of the working class, out of our central cities and into our inner ring suburbs where there's dilapidating infrastructure. These were often our first sites of white flight with housing that is now considered not to be very valuable, not very valuable for the real estate market. You have crumbling infrastructure from declining tax bases there. And so you have an incredible movement of people from our cities, even from in places like Detroit, towards the inner suburban ring. And then you have the objective of realizing the tremendous amount of capital that is in fact locked up, the tremendous amount of value that is in fact locked up in urban spaces like in Detroit. And that's hard for some people to believe because they look at Detroit and they think, well, you know, you can go there and buy a house for $500 or $1,000 right now. So what value is really there? Well, it is a value that needs to be cultivated, but it's not that difficult to imagine how it is cultivated. And we see so many examples of how this works in many other parts of the United States where it's well ahead of where it is in Detroit. But you do have this sort of urban dream, this dream of return. And there's oftentimes the metaphors that are used are, they sicken me, but you have everything from the well-worn urban pioneer metaphor, which is deeply racist, and we need to remember that urban pioneers in the colonial period and the settling of the United States during the time of Manifest Destiny, that was all about the erasure of people of color then as well, indigenous people of color. And it's really the same idea now with the urban pioneers. But you have that metaphor. You also have metaphors about homecoming. The local Cranes business magazine talks a lot about not only homecoming, but also expats. It's time for expats to come back. There's this sort of nostalgia for the city left behind. And so you have this problem that Detroit has been very successfully branded as this nightmare. You know, Detroit more than even Pittsburgh or Newark or others, Gary or others, as this the stuff of white people's nightmare fantasies, right? So how do you undo that? Well, one of the things you have to do is you have to break up black space. You have to break up space that is perceived in the white imaginary to be held by African Americans, that has deeply African American meanings embedded into it. And part of that means closing down a lot of black schools, renaming schools, opening new charter schools. So we have phenomena, we have all of this happening at the same time. We have in Detroit the closing of some of our most successful schools that were doing amazing things despite existing in a sea of poverty, despite being underfunded. We had Oakman Orthopedic School, where the emergency manager appointed by Governor Snyder over the Detroit Public Schools closed a school that was highly successful based on a series of lies that we were able to expose. And even exposing those fabrications in front of the legislature, in front of the State Board of Education and others, didn't stop the school from being closed down nonetheless. We had a school that frequently has been cited by the U.S. News and World Report as one of the top in the country, and that was highlighted as recently as 2009 by emergency managers in Detroit as the kind of school that needs to be replicated, Davis Aerospace, moved away from the airport where it used to have a hangar, where it had several planes, where there was FAA certification, where students could learn to be a pilot, they could learn to work on aircraft engines. And that program was moved away into a vocational center where the students not only don't have the planes and don't have the access to the equipment that they did before in the hangar, but because of zoning ordinances can't work on jet engines. The FAA has taken away its certification. So why do you do this? Why do you close some of the most successful schools across the city? Well, there is an important incentive to de-blacken those spaces, to cleanse them. And the way that that happens in Detroit, and it's highly connected to education, is a process of what I call, it's a kind of sanitation of the city, a kind of cleansing of the city that is sort of analogous to the way that green fields were created in the suburban dream for many whites, where the idea was you could go out into these unsullied by race lands far away from the city center. Now, of course, they were sullied because they are built on the blood and bones of Native American communities that were exterminated, some of whom still exist and are still being oppressed. But now the idea is in Detroit, we have something called the Detroit Future City Plan. And what the Detroit Future City Plan does, and I'll pause here in just a moment, Utris, in case you want to steer me in a particular direction, because the Detroit Future City Plan is a long discussion. But what the Detroit Future City does is it designates certain areas of the city for mothballing and sort of a return to nature. And the language is one of establishing parks and forests and farms, and also blue spaces, which are, you know, nice water features, as a way of cleansing those of their deeply invested racial meanings and making them available for future controlled accumulation by gradually releasing them onto the real estate market. I'll say more about that in a moment, but I think I'll pause for just a second.
This is great stuff. I could just listen to this. I hope people are appreciating the fact that your sophisticated analysis as you related, it's so clear, but we can't seem to connect the dots at all. Yeah. And this is why I keep saying Detroit in so many ways is a template of what is to come in all these major cities across the country. And it, not just what is to come, what is actually happening. You're using words that are the highly charged words like cleansing, and the sanitization, the cleaning up of the de-blackening of the spaces. These are very emotionally and psychologically very violent words. Yes. What could the ulterior motive be? Why is it that this program is being conducted to just desanitize and to cleanse these communities, to hold them in abeyance for future action. And that is exactly what's going on in Detroit right now, and in other places. But I want you to return us to this, because when you spoke of it the last time we talked, it left a deep impression on me, this Katrina moment.
Well, one thing we need to say is that what is happening now is very sophisticated, right? So, there are a lot of what you might call progressive moments in something like the Detroit Future City Plan. I mean, if you look at it just casually, what you see are wonderful pictures of bike paths and green spaces and water features, the restoration of rivers that have long been covered over. And so it is extremely seductive. And I guess I don't want to say it's just seductive. There are people who are invested in that plan who really do believe in its progressivity for creating livable spaces, for sort of undoing the paved over city, which is all about the car, and restoring it to something more humane. So one of the things I want to say is that the banking groups that helped through Living Cities as the entity to create this vision for Detroit are very smart. They know that you can't speak in a starkly racial language when proposing a particular program, that you do want that sort of community investment, that you do want the sense of that this is something for the community, that this reflects the most positive visions of what the urban canon should be all about. And there are plenty of images of diversity and tolerance for difference, including of LGBTQ people, in the materials that you read about the process of change. But we do know at the same time that the underlying problem that is faced is that there is tremendous value to be recognized in the city, to be unlocked, but there really is this huge marketing problem. And there are a bunch of problems. There's the marketing problem due to race, and there's also the problem that you have so much land that is all available at once, so much property that is all available at once, that the market is flooded. And so when we talk about the Katrina-like moment, I think the phrase that you and I both use, which I think was very resonant with what is happening here, is talking about Detroit's Katrina or Detroit's Katrina moment. And really that moment was, you know, it just to kind of put some meat on the bones, hope you're not a vegetarian, or at least you can appreciate the
These
metaphor.
Days I am, really.
Okay, well, I'll be more cautious, okay? But what you had, the problem in Detroit is that you didn't have a hurricane, right? You didn't have a man-made disaster that followed a natural phenomenon like a hurricane like you did in Katrina in New Orleans. And as we know, and specifically in education, Arne Duncan, the U.S. Secretary of Education, has called Hurricane Katrina the greatest thing that ever happened for the New Orleans public schools, because basically you had a lot of educational interests, but also a lot of real estate interests sort of working in lockstep. Who saw this as their grand moment. They'd already been working behind the scenes, but this created a point of entry for them to really push forward a program of changing the complexion of New Orleans, changing the way that its public schools operated, smashing the teachers' unions, and really changing the character of the city in the way that has unlocked tremendous value for some while dispossessing huge swaths of the city's historical residents who you have to always remember provide the very character and attractiveness of New Orleans that everyone celebrates. So you want to capitalize on the cultural resonance of a place by New Orleans, but at the same time you want to reduce the very threat that the people who created that sort of cultural resonance embody to developers and to whites in their fears of the city. But so Detroit didn't have Hurricane Katrina, but what it did have, like many cities, is it has a constellation of factors, but the most important one that I want to highlight is the predatory lending, the foreclosure crisis, and the eventual financial crisis, which of course was also global in scope. And I live in a small working class and middle class community called Ypsilanti, which is between Ann Arbor and Detroit. And one of the things that I notice when I look at housing values all across this region, all across the metropolitan Detroit region, is that in most places, there are some exceptions, in most places, housing values took a hit after, you know, from 2008 on. The house where I live has recovered most of its value. It's probably at 85 or 90% of its value before the crash. So, you know, still hurts, but it's survivable, that sort of thing. But in Detroit, if you look at those values, there's still huge swaths of the city that are at only 30% or more or less of their value before the 2008 downturn. And this hasn't been written about this way very much, but it really needs to be. What that was, you know, people just think of Detroit and they think of poverty and they think, well, it was kind of already destroyed, so, you know, it just got destroyed a little bit more. Well, actually what it was one of the largest decimations of black wealth that's happened in this hemisphere. So Detroit, as poor as it might have been because of the tremendous damage done by a variety of factors like the industrialization and government-subsidized white flights and all of these sorts of things, still, Detroit was, in terms of its city size, was the center of black homeownership in the United States. And what I like to always point out is that this homeownership, much of it originated in the Great Migration North, in Detroit from the 20s, but accelerating in the 40s. And most importantly, I want to note that the war heroism of so many African Americans who came north around the time of the Second World War to work in the retooled factories, which were serving the defense industry at that time in the World War II effort, that it was African Americans who played a tremendous role, not only in fighting and being segregated in the armed forces at that time, but also in the production side at home with weaponry and planes and so on, played a very key role. Okay. So anyway, at that time, what the small amounts of wealth, and I don't want to romanticize it, but the small amounts of wealth that were accumulated by African Americans at that time in cities like Detroit, you know, we have to remember there were still glass ceilings in terms of how far you could advance, what kind of jobs you could do, even in terms of your inclusion in the union. But still, enough modest accumulation of wealth that you could sometimes actually afford to buy a house. And this represented the first accumulation of African-American land and a small, modest bit of wealth and a home in the Western Hemisphere, right? Because people who were coming north with the Great Migration North endured slavery, they'd endured chattel slavery in the form of sharecropping, they'd endured the Jim Crow South, and now, not to romanticize the North and by any means, but industry provided some opportunity to accumulate something. And so what you have in Detroit right now, what you've had is some sectors of the city, some neighborhoods where African Americans have multi-generationally been in some of those homes. And the homes have deep vested meanings in terms of black space, what they mean to those families and what they mean to the community. And so, first of all, so much of that wealth was decimated in 2008-2009 through so much foreclosure that resulted from the financial crisis, generally from predatory lending and all those things, being the perfect storm for Detroit, much as Hurricane Katrina was for New Orleans. And so as a result of that, you continue to have a mass exodus outside of Detroit, and you have the creation of large open spaces, or at least you have the creation of a situation where the city has a much lower population than it did at one time. And that allows for a progressive sounding argument that says, well, we've got to reduce the footprint of the city because, you know, it's a city built for 2 million, it has the infrastructure for 2 million, and we can't simply afford to do that anymore, especially with falling revenues. There's an element of truth to that, but what it does is it opens up the space not only for what might be the most progressive explanations or the most progressive solutions to how to handle that. But also it opens the door, just like in New Orleans with its Katrina, for others to enter to push forward an agenda that works the most for them. So this brings me kind of back to Detroit Future Cities, and I'll always try to return to talking about in terms of education as well. But what the Detroit Future Cities Project does is really very radical, but not in a good way. And It's something that I don't think has received the attention that it's due, and I think it will receive this attention, and maybe you're helping in a significant way right now. But what it does is it redefines neighborhoods all across Detroit largely in terms of a tool called market value analysis. And what market value analysis does is it first goes census tract by census tract across the entire city to assess what the housing market condition, the housing value is, and the state of the market in each of those census tracts. And once it's sort of labeled and also, you know, followed through with by careful GIS-led coding of sections all across the city in terms of the state of the housing that's actually there, it basically determines the market health of each of those small census tracts. And they'll sort of get conglomerated with each other into larger areas, so you can roughly say, well, this area is a poor performing housing market, this area is a steady performing market, this one is performing well, this one is sort of transitional, we don't know what's going to happen. But what it is it's a tremendous neoliberal success in that it redefines neighborhoods not as how we used to think of them, as poor neighborhoods, as wealthy neighborhoods, as neighborhoods of the working class that maybe had a claim to state assistance to help them under an older model of what the citizen relationship at least rhetorically meant to the social contract and to the state, but now defined in terms of market performance. So basically the argument is one that is embedded in austerity politics, and one that says in this moment of the austerity of the state, and, you know, the crisis of the state in its municipal form and statewide form, we need to be very careful how we disperse these very limited public funds. And what we should do with these public funds is we should disperse them to market winners, not market losers. We don't want to subsidize market losers. We want to put money, we don't want to throw good money after bad. We want to put that money where the investment is paying off. We want to subsidize. We want to help out the market performers. We want to reward them and incentivize them. So what does that mean in terms of, you know, the families and the children on the street across Detroit? It means if you were formerly thought of as a poor neighborhood, you now live in a poorly performing housing market, and you should not receive public subsidy. You should not receive those scarce public dollars. Those should still instead go to the investments that are the most likely to pay off. They should go to the market winners, the ones with the greatest market potential. And so, again, the way that is dressed up is a little more friendly than the way I just laid it out. I mean, first it was laid out more starkly when David Bing first put forward publicly this plan that was created by Living Cities, again, an agglomeration of banks, both national and international.
David Bing is a former mayor of the city of Detroit.
That's correct. He was the mayor of Detroit around the time 2009, 2010, particular instances that I'm referring to. He's a former basketball player with no elected experience before that, actually a failed businessman as well, but was served briefly as mayor, and during that time, I'm thinking now about March 2010, he announced this plan for shutting down parts of the city. He called it right-sizing or downsizing the city, and he wasn't a skilled politician any more than he was skilled. I guess he was a good basketball player, but he wasn't a skilled politician or a skilled businessman. And he made this slight blunder in that he said he was asked if there would be forced relocations of people out of traditionally black neighborhoods, and he said forced relocations, absolutely. And he had to sort of step that back, and the language had to be made a little bit more subtle, so that language eventually disappeared. And long story short, there were a couple of different iterations, and the current iteration is that the Future City Plan says it's not that there's not going to be any public investment in the poorly performing housing markets. It's going to be a different type of investment because we recognize diversity, and we want to make the investment relative to the type of neighborhood that you are. So it's sort of dressed up in a positive recognition of difference. But what does that actually mean on the ground? They do say there's going to be public investment in all of the different housing markets. It's just a different kind of investment. What does it mean? It means if you live in one of the poorly performing housing markets, which covers a large section of the city, And you just, I want to make sure I'm still here because I heard a click.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Okay, we're good. Okay. If you live in one of those poorly performing housing markets, you're going to still get some public investment. But what it means is, let's say that the infrastructure at question is sewage lines. It means if there's a rupture in the sewage main, that we'll put a patch on it to try to prolong the life as much as possible of that utility. But in other neighborhoods that are highly performing housing markets, if their infrastructure starts to degrade, we won't put a patch on it to extend the life. What we'll do is we'll upgrade the whole system. And so basically there are huge swaths of the city that are designated for only this sort of patchwork maintenance of urban infrastructure. And these neighborhoods are to be phased out over the next 10 years. A decision about their final status will be made after 10 years. Some of them not through city-created or state-created miracles, but through some other sort of miracle, could survive. But the rest of them will be phased out and will be mothballed. Now, I recently drove through the entire city, or at least through all the parts of the city that were labeled with this pretty purple color, which meant that they were phased to be differently publicly subsidized and basically phased out over 10 years. And some of those neighborhoods really do feel truly vacant. You know, they're sort of the spaces that people have described of large open fields where there were once houses and pheasants and coyotes, those do exist. But the definition of vacant also includes portions of the city that actually have population densities that are much greater than suburban population densities, you know, and certainly much greater than rural population densities. And so some of these neighborhoods that are slated in this way on the map as poorly performing housing markets, you drive through and you see, and I saw, the mail being delivered, children coming home from school. You hear the sounds of people fixing up their houses, you know, buzz saws and hammers. And these folks are not aware, I'm sure, that the fate that has been assigned to their neighborhood. Because if they were, you know, you think about what does it do to your housing value, when the value of your home, when someone who is a savvy participant in the housing market knows your area is slated to be phased out in 10 years, so why am I going to pay anything for your house whatsoever? It's basically destroying any residual housing value for those families that are located in that area. So part of the rationale for this, in the words of John Hance of Hance Farms, who originally wanted to build large swaths of urban garden over many, many, many acres of a zone of the city that just happens to be located near Belle Isle, which is one of the gems of Detroit, one of the largest urban parks in the United States, easily rivals Central Park in its beauty, just happens to be located pretty close to Belle Isle and to the bridge that crosses over it, and also is located very close to Indian Village and East English Village, areas that have a lot of historical value and that are seeing a lot of growth right now. He created this farm zone, and he said that the benefit of this was not only that he was creating this beautiful green space, and now he said he's not growing crops, but he's growing trees instead. But in addition to creating this green space, he said, and I think it's very accurate and very helpful for us in thinking about what's going on, he said that he's helping to create scarcity. And see, that's the problem, is when you have so much housing and land that is all available at one time for so cheap, it's hard for you to turn a profit. What you want to do is you want to take a large swath of the city off the market by designating them as green space, as blue space, to sort of mothball them and only put them back on the market when it's ready, when the market is no longer saturated. It's sort of
My head is spinning. Because supposedly we're talking about education.
Yeah.
And supposedly we're talking about public schools and public policy. But
yes,
as it relates to education. But you're telling us a whole different thing is happening here. Behind all of this, there is a group of people, an industry essentially, that is devoted to basically the fine art of real estate values, and that is in turn dictating how public spaces are managed. And in these public spaces, if they happen to be schools, well, it's just another casualty of the policymaking. So you're telling us you're taking us into a place we don't expect to go. When we start talking about education, why are we talking about spaces and ethnic cleansing and real estate values and all these other kinds of things? Aren't we supposed to just be talking about public schools and the future of our children?
Well, and again, I want to share my indebtedness to people, especially like Pauline Littman, who has brought this sort of analysis very successfully in Chicago and has influenced the entire urban sociological world. It's not very often that educational researchers, we're usually sort of down in the pecking order, and we don't usually make a big impact back on the primary disciplines. But in this case, she has really succeeded in doing that, and people have followed suit very capably, again, in places like New Orleans with Kristen Burris and her work there, which obviously relates very, very highly to the kinds of questions that you're raising, Utrus. But yeah, in Detroit too. I mean, what we need to think about is really the centrality of schools and education to real estate value, I think is so important. So I think that's obvious to a lot of people who have gone to buy a house, right? Because one of the most important factors in buying a house is what are the quality of the schools. This is something that, you know, even middle-class families like my own are very familiar with. And then when you consider, and this is a question relevant not to just you and your own children, but it's also relevant to the future resale value of your home. So what is the quality of the schools? And when we say quality, we know what we really mean, right? We don't really mean quality. We don't really mean how hard are the teachers working, what kind of skills and aptitudes they bring. We mean what is the racial, socioeconomic, class, linguistic, ethnic mix of the school. Because that directly reflects not only where our own kids will attend, but it also is in terms of the resale value of our home. If we say, well, we don't have kids, but we're going to buy this house, and we want to sell it again later on, well, its value is directly related to who attends the schools that are nearby. So that gets to the question of whose schools need to be closed down and whose need to be kept open, and what new schools need to be opened up. So in Chicago, someone like Pauline Littman, what she has done is she's showed where there's not as much this phenomena of mothballing neighborhoods, where the gentrification agenda was slowed down by the financial collapse in 2008, but is picking up again, is where you have, in the same moment, you have charter schools that are popping up for new folks, read largely white and or middle class, alongside the so-called failing public school that is being closed down. So it's sort of this block-by-block war over the city, where the school that has deep black residents or their Latino residents is shut down, and a new charter school with a newly vested racial meanings is opened up. Now, that looks different in different cities. In Detroit, it looks a little bit different than in Chicago, because Chicago also has open spaces. I don't want to say it's completely different, but you know, Detroit is a different kind of city, and that's one of the things that Pauline Littman and I have actually been exploring, is how different the types of cities are educationally and in terms of their position within global markets, within globalization. All cities are rebranding themselves now that we're no longer in a moment of the national economy, and we talk about a global economy. And that makes Chicago a different kind of city than Detroit. So Chicago is a city that was not dependent on a single industry. It did have hard industrial manufacturing, like Detroit, but it also has finance industry. It has a lot of other things that it can turn to become a global city. And in fact, it's thought of as a global city, whereas Detroit was very largely dependent on the auto industry, sometimes not as exclusively as people will say, but you know, dependent on an industry that went global, that was actually profitable in Detroit and Metro Detroit, but has found ways to produce even global, even greater profitability, which of course is its responsibility, I guess you could say, to its shareholders, and has pursued a strategy that has just left Detroit decimated, along with all the, it's not the only element, there's also white flight and all this other kind of stuff. But so Detroit is in a very different place of needing to try to market itself back to the world in a way that it's not having the same sort of assets that Chicago does in order to be able to do that. And so that reflects itself in the schools battle as well. But the, so there are both commonalities and there are also differences that are very interesting. So in Detroit, what you have is you can look back at housing market studies that were done of the city, and you can see that basically the argument that was being made whenever the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation commissioned one of these studies of potential real estate value is the message was always, well, the whole city isn't a basket case. Most of it is. But there are certain areas that are near downtown or along certain cultural corridors or along the river that do have housing market profit potential, even in the context of so much decimation and destruction. I mean, these studies were being done during the height of the foreclosure crisis and the financial crisis. And so, but what you need to do is you need to take other areas of the city off the market in order to concentrate value and increase scarcity in the parts of the market that are the target right now. So, you know, what you do have is you do have some areas of Detroit that are basically being closed down, and their schools are being closed, and it's more the model of just mothballing and shutting down. It doesn't really matter whether the programs were successful or not. And then you have other areas of the city where it's more about handing control over to a new population that is, frankly, that loves the grittiness of Detroit, that wants to put its Detroit Hustles Harder bumper sticker on its laptop, that wants to talk about how gritty Detroit is, that likes the dangerous feeling, that wants to identify with hip-hop at Eminem and be seen as those sort of rough, rugged urban pioneers, but who frankly don't want too much exposure to those people and their realities. And so what's interesting, actually, is that very rebranding. It's not like the marketing of Detroit is as if it's a white city. Its branding is, this is a city of Motown, this is a city of Eminem. It's kind of, you're welcome to sort of participate in that toughness and ruggedness, even if it doesn't reflect your own background at all. But at the same time, you are to be insulated from too much exposure to that element, just like in New Orleans. You love the jazz, love the sort of bordello-style flavor that you get in the French Quarter, but you don't want it. It's also one of the most policed areas in the United States. You don't really want any exposure to the culture that actually generated those, you know, incredible art forms. And it's the same thing in Detroit as well. You don't really want to go to school with those people, right? And so then on those areas that are being gentrified, you do really have that block-by-block struggle over the schools and who gets to control them and whose schools they are.
This is a fascinating aspect that you're raising here. Yeah. I must note that a very interesting thing today, I read your opinion piece published in the Detroit Free Press. The headline says, Detroiters must have real control over Detroit schools, and you wrote that with Karen Toomey. But what was interesting was that also, another piece appeared in the Detroit Free Press that says, Whites Moving to Detroit, City that epitomized white flight. So both, we're talking on the same day that these articles came out, basically affirming exactly what you've been talking about, the different ways of seeing this.
Yeah, and it's funny because we've actually tried in strategizing how to get democratic control back to the Detroit public schools, we've actually begun to think strategically about what sort of arguments we could make about the need for democratic control. And it's not to say that democratic control is a panacea, right? I mean, because when you do have democratic control of the schools through an elected school board, it just means that the moneyed interests will pour lots of money into their candidates and skew the elections to their interest, but we still think that democratic participation is a much better platform for a radical social politics than state imposition, whether it's through emergency manager or an mayorally appointed board or whatever it might be. So we actually have made the argument. We said, look, all these, you know, I'm going to say it a little crassly now just for the benefit of your show. It's not how I really say it in public. Oh, this is public, isn't it? I say, look, all those white people who you want to move into the city, they're not going to tolerate this top-down governance that is based on the premise that black people are not capable of governing themselves, right? I mean, that's the underlying premise of emergency management. formerly over the city and also over the Troy Public Schools, is that you all manufactured this terrible situation that you're in, and the good white fathers back in Lansing want to help you because we really care ultimately about your children more than you do, and so we're going to take away your elected governance because you don't know who to vote for. You vote the wrong people in, and we're going to do what's right, and we're going to come in and take care of your kids because you won't do it and make the schools right. That's sort of the underlying idea behind emergency management. And so what we say back is, you know, that might be what you want for black folks in the racist way that you think of it, and the sort of plantation narratives that you assign of that, that say that, you know, that blacks are better under white control and domination, that they need to be taken care of like children in that way. You're the one who deploys that argument, but the only problem is you want white folks to move in, and they're not going to tolerate this sort of state imposition. They're going to want real control, meaningful control, like they have in the suburbs from which they are moving. They're not going to, they don't want that. And so it actually becomes a leverage point, although a problematic one, in arguing for more democratic control of the city is, you know, those that people who are really looked at as being full citizens and not second-class citizens won't tolerate living like second-class citizens. It's a complex argument, but it's still one that you need to make in order to, you know, ultimately have a platform, albeit as problematic as it might be with democracy and the relation of money and power in democracy, to some sort of social project that says that schools can be places that are not just about help, you know, they should be equal so that black kids can advance and get some sort of, you know, live the American dream of materialism or whatever it might be, but also that schools can become meaningful sites, not just where test scores are produced as a commodity, but also where kids can actively learn to think critically about the world and the situations in which they find themselves to begin to see knowledge as something that can be a tool for them in contesting that world and to asserting the kind of world that they want to live in.
Well, you're a very educated man, and you've done a lot of research, and you have expertise in this area. But when did it dawn on you that this aspect of analysis really was missing from your understanding? When did that dawn on you?
Well, it came to me in a couple of different ways. I mean, some of it I've already mentioned, which is through reading the work of others who are thinking about other cities in this way. But part of it also came, to be quite honest, with my frustration with some of my educational colleagues. So right now, whether you're sincere or not as an educational researcher, there's still a lot of social mobility that you can get out of being interested in the lives of African-American and Latino school children and writing about what form of education would serve them better than the one that they currently have. And that research is still ongoing, but I would look at my colleagues and I'd say, you're writing about something that you're becoming, and your research is becoming increasingly irrelevant to, because, you know, fewer and fewer students are coming through you on the place, on the path of becoming teachers or becoming teacher certified, because many of them are now going, especially in our cities, through Teach for America or through other online programs or alternative programs. And you increasingly are excluded from, you as a researcher, a faculty member, are excluded from being able to have a real impact on what's happening in the schools because they don't value you. They see you as a self-interested person who's on the side of the unions and probably even in their pocket. And so you're the problem when, you know, in this era of Republican and in Michigan, DeVos funded, you know, DeVos, Amway money, huge, very right-wing source of funding for a lot of organizations and foundations, and politicians and movements. Your ability to have impact with all of your progressive research is almost none. It may still be serving your career. You're still getting tenure. You're publishing. But in terms of real impact, you know, the very terrain on which you would act is disappearing. You know, they're not going to be doing your progressive methodologies for African-American children when those children are all sitting in front of computers using some sort of shell platform that is really about a for-profit company being able to claim success and then sell that in other urban districts. So what I basically began to think is the whole constellation of thinking, even from a radical or progressive direction about urban education and urban education reform, is missing this whole spatial element, is missing this whole element about contestation over the city, the urban social context of poverty isn't just a static container that isn't changing. It's actively changing. It's being reworked. And it's moving in a direction where the very object that you're describing, writing pedagogy and research about, is changing. It's very malleable, and it's changing radically. And that you've actually have to be, that it doesn't make sense to talk about critical urban education research if you're not also taking into account this dispossession. I can't remember the word, this cleansing, and you just used other words too.
Yeah.
Quarantining, I think is the word that you used, or, you know, this packaging away of urban populations. They can still say they can be in the entering urban suburbs that are falling apart, or they can be on the less desirable fringes of the city, but they have to be sort of contained in those areas.
We have to leave it there for today, okay. I'm afraid. But what an extraordinary insight to begin this, I hope, continuing discussion, because we really have to get a handle on this and to understand what it is we're looking at when we talk about education, public school education, and how it has evolved without even our knowing, you know.
Yes.
You've put us ahead of the subject in that sense. Thank you so much for joining me today, and we look forward to part two, which I hope we can reschedule soon, very, very soon. So thanks so much.
I would love that, Utris. Thank you. Enjoy your time in the Everglades.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it opened your eyes and your minds, and again, basically yanked the chain a little bit to say, wake up. This thing is very, very serious, and there are people with plans, and they are putting their plans into gear. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook. I have to really get current with the Facebook page and with keeping up with my correspondence. But you can still reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Thank you.